Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine, and over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is a mystery case. We have the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Brocky. He's on the other end of the line, and I'm going to try to stump him medically. I don't know what my batting average is yet, but to be clear, I would have been demoted to the minors. I would have quit. They would have been calling for my job. That's the extent of my sports analogies and metaphors for the day. But how's it going, Dr. B?
Hey, doing all right. I just finished up a training session, did some reverse grip bench, some Jefferson curls, and spent some time on a bike. So that was my day today.
You're just trying to offend all of the traditionalists.
Exactly.
You flipped your hands around for the bench press, yep. And then you intentionally deadlifted with the flexed spine.
Yep. Correct. And then I did some conditioning. Yeah.
I just really wonder how you'd fare with an overhead squat, you know, assessment to see what's tight and what's weak, what's strong and overpowered. You know,
I'd be more likely to fail that than I have a medical mystery case. So
that is a great segue. All right. So look, if you're just joining us here, if this is your first Barbell Medicine podcast, hey, thank you. Welcome to the Barbell Medicine sort of
cinematic
audio
universe.
That's right. Yeah. Our media conglomerate. What we're doing here on mystery cases is these are real cases published in various places in the medical literature. I find them, they all, as of right now, pertain to exercise on some level because, you know, that is our bag, baby, to quote the great philosopher of our time, Austin Powers, who I think also is a medical doctor. I mean, he's probably going to get nominated for something in the political office, just given how this is going. But so what we do is I present the case piece by piece to Dr. Brocky. And he kind of summarizes his thoughts as what I would do, what he would do next, sort of concerns, and kind of leads us through the process of arriving at a diagnosis. Now, if you want to play along at home, I will prompt you at various points to pause the audio, think about what you just learned, and see if you can come up with a diagnosis or potential treatment, depending on the prompt. Okay, so you get to do some active learning here, even if you're not in the healthcare space. This is just fun, I think, if you're at least at all scientifically curious. And yeah, people love medical stuff.
People seem to really enjoy these, so we'll keep doing them.
Gets the people going. All right. Anything else before we start? Do you want to, you know, phone a friend? Do you want to, like, get some lifelines in order? Are you good?
I'm good. Let's do it.
All right. 21-year-old female presents to the emergency department for a six-hour history of severe throat pain with swallowing and a sore throat at rest. Now, 6 hours ago, she was exercising in the gym as she normally does. She reports that today's session had heavy squats and deadlifts, which again, she normally does, and she tolerated them well. There was no report of how much she was actually lifting, but let's just assume that she's very, very strong. She returned home and started feeling a sharp throat pain that got worse over about an hour. She took Tylenol and ibuprofen and tried to go to sleep, but the pain continued to get worse, so she came to the emergency department. She denies any associated cough, any chest pain, any shortness of breath, no fever, no headaches, or recent sick contacts. Her past medical history is significant for GERD, so acid reflux, which she manages with lifestyle, and she has never been hospitalized or had an episode like this before. She does take an oral contraceptive, but otherwise no medications. She does not smoke and denies the use of recreational drugs. So before we go any further, Austin, and this is the play at home type part of the podcast, why don't you summarize the patient, give people a lay of the land, what you're thinking about, and then we can go on.
All right. So we have this 21-year-old woman who seems to be pretty healthy overall, aside from some minor reflux, it seems, who's coming in with 6 hours of seemingly pretty severe progressive throat pain. And typically, if a patient describes to me that they're having throat pain, I kind of mentally translate that into like neck, usually anterior neck. And that's just so that I don't prematurely kind of focus exclusively on the throat, but rather that there are other structures in the neck and around that area that can also lead to pain. This is also throat pain that's worsened with swallowing, which has some relevance. It doesn't necessarily nail a specific diagnosis for me yet, but that's kind of where I'm at. So we have this acute, very acute, progressive, severe throat pain exacerbated by swallowing. Now, the case report is in the context of exercise. She also did some training earlier in the day. It would not be safe for me to assume that this syndrome is directly related to that. It could be completely independent, coincidental, so I have to entertain both possibilities that it could be related or not. And so just taking my usual thought process around the concern of sore throat, particularly acute sore throat, or what is sometimes called pharyngitis, the most common reason we see this in general is going to be infectious. And there are a variety of different types of infections that can cause a sore throat or pharyngitis. There are a lot of different viruses, which most people would be familiar with and would have experienced at some point in their lives. Standard respiratory viruses can cause what's called an upper respiratory infection, often accompanied by a sore throat. There are several bacterial infections that can cause a sore throat. Both, you know, run-of-the-mill strep, for example, certain sexually transmitted infections, and some other less common bacteria, although their presentation doesn't tend to be as abrupt as this is. This was like, she was completely fine, and then this syndrome kind of exploded really quickly. And that makes even other causes of sore throat, like fungal infections and other things, even less likely, because those are even slower. So that's the infectious category. There are some conditions related to certain types of cancers, like leukemias and lymphomas, that can cause sore throat, various autoimmune diseases. One of my favorite conditions that I find fascinating, called Still's disease, can cause sore throat and usually presents with very inflammatory kind of symptoms and a sore throat. None of them are really hitting right now in terms of the context of this syndrome. There are still a few others that can do this, and this is why I broaden it beyond just stuff going on in the throat, where you can have infections and, you know, immune system activation and things like that, but also around the throat and in the neck, we have blood vessels, right? So there are blood vessels that can potentially get dissected, so you can have a dissection of the carotid artery that can cause neck pain. You can have a venous clot, for example, in the jugular vein. That can also be associated with infections. There's a commonly known condition in patients in their 20s who have sore throat and infected clots in their jugular vein called Lemierre syndrome that we're taught to never miss in the context of medical training. And then additionally, your thyroid gland is in the front. And so thyroiditis, so inflammation of the thyroid gland, can itself also cause neck pain, and it kind of in the anterior neck that patients can sometimes interpret as throat pain, and it can also be exacerbated by swallowing. So there's a handful of things that come to mind when I hear about a patient who has acute sore throat, and in particular, a patient like this one, where I'm worried about certain infections or some kind of vascular problem or thyroiditis. Basically, I'm worried about what structure is it in the anterior neck or the throat that is inflamed most often, leading to this pain. The suddenness of this is what is biasing me towards, if it is an infection, maybe a bit more viral, although even then it's awfully rapid, versus maybe something vascular or something related to the thyroid gland, which still doesn't fit perfectly. But that's kind of where I'm starting out right now.
Yeah, again, your differential just has to be broad enough to get the right diagnosis. And so that seemed adequately wide. I can't say yes or no whether you are on the right track.
You do.
sidebar, and both of these sidebars, it's kind of the same sidebar. And they're all related to language, okay? Do you remember the first time you ever saw odynophagia on a chart? Odynophagia?
Sure. Yeah.
Did you just panic? Did you immediately just start fibrillating like body-wide? I was like, I know what phagia means. I know what I have a general, okay, so my pain. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
I think almost any word that starts with an O in medicine, I'm like, is this a different country spelling? Like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, the interesting thing about this case is that the patient's primary concern, at least at what started, and then what seems to be the main concern when she showed up, was the throat pain. And that's not a syndrome that I would usually label as odynephagia, which is a term, medical term, to describe usually like pain with swallowing is more the provocative kind of thing, where maybe they don't have a ton of pain if they're not actively swallowing or eating, but whenever they do, it is quite painful.
Yeah.
And so if I have that history incorrect, then the way I think about things in terms of odynephagia is very different than the way I would think about in terms of pharyngitis. Do you have a sense of whether this was more she had pain just with swallowing and no pain without, or was it pain the whole time and it just got worse when she swallowed?
Yes, to the latter. She has pain at rest, throat pain at rest, but it is worsened with swallowing. And I believe that was her main, that's what made her like get out of bed and come into the ED.
Yeah. One of the differences, once people have more so of a syndrome of, I feel okay in general, but when I swallow, it is quite painful. Then the concern translates a lot more down into the esophagus. We worry about various kinds of esophagitis, either from reflux or infections in the esophagus, or, you know, various other forms of injury to the esophagus or obstructions in the esophagus, things like that. So that's kind of where my attention would shift. If she was like, I feel okay, except when I try to swallow, it hurts real bad, versus I have pain in my throat all the time and the swallowing just makes it worse.
Yeah. The second language related thing, I have PTSD from this, and I'm not saying this in a joking way to like minimize people who do experience. This is legitimate.
You have active flashbacks and avoidance of this particular issue. Okay.
Yes. I was during my master's program. I got a master's in clinical anatomy and physiology. I was, we took like these shifts where we would prepare all of the bodies to be dissected in the anatomy lab for either the medical students or for the physical therapy students or the PA students. And so this was my like time to shine, get all the bodies ready, do some prosections, whatever. And, you know, I'm wheeling a body into the room to do a prosection on head and neck. Right. And my advisor pops his head out of the room. Hey, Feigenbaum, how's it going? I'm like, oh, you know, just getting ready to go dissect this, you know, do this prosection. And I said, dissect. And out of nowhere, this woman, another professor, she was a great professor, actually, sticks her head out the window. She goes, what did you say? Remind me of like the SpongeBob, the leaning meme or whatever. I was like, I'm really excited to go dissect. She goes, what? I was, I'm really excited to go dissect. And she goes, dissect, dissect. It's always dissect. And from that moment on, I actually never spoke again during my master's program. I just completely,
vow of silence the rest of the time.
Yeah, no, I was aphasic. I didn't actually speak. And so now I can't ever go back into that lab. I can't ever see that woman again. And if anyone asks me what I'm about to do to a cadaver and I happen to be doing a blank, I sign it to them, actually. I don't actually say it out loud, so they
can't.
This
is one reason, among others, why professors can be the worst.
Yeah, I wish Rate My Professor was around back then. Okay, so a 21-year-old female with throat pain, worse upon swallowing, 6-hour history after doing some heavy squats and deadlifts. And I feel like whoever this is would appreciate me describing her squats and deadlifts as heavy. Okay, let's move along to a physical exam in some labs. So first off, her vital signs are all within normal limits. So she's normal oxygen sats on room air, so she doesn't require any additional oxygen. She's afebrile. She has a normal respiratory rate, normal pulse. She's chilling. On exam, she is in no acute apparent distress. External neck exam appears normal. No swelling, no bruising, no erythema. Trachea is midline. She has full range of motion in the neck without pain. No masses or tenderness to palpation. Her oral exam is also unremarkable with no inflammation or exudate of the tonsils noted. Her uvula is also midline. Chest exam was significant for tenderness to palpation over the sternoclavicular joints bilaterally and also midline trachea at this particular level. So just above that sternomanubrial notch, if you recall back to your anatomy days. Her cardiac exam was within normal limits, normal rate and rhythm. Lung exam was clear. It's full range of motion and strength in both upper and lower extremities. We'll move on to some laboratory data here. It's got a small white count to 10.5, which I know you immediately shrug off. Her basic metabolic panel is normal. Her CRP level, which they drew for some reason, was also normal. They did EKG that showed normal sinus rhythm, nothing of concern there. And her chest x-ray was clear, no pneumomediastinum, no pneumothorax. There's a neck x-ray pending. Before we go any further, again, if you're playing along at home, this is the time where you get to sort of synthesize your thoughts, come up with maybe a new and improved differential diagnosis. But I turn this to you, Dr. Baraki. What's going on with this patient?
Yeah, this is an odd syndrome. So whatever this case is, you found a good one, I think. So this woman presenting with really abrupt onset and rapidly progressive, I would say, throat / anterior neck pain exacerbated by swallowing. And yeah, we're going to keep tying in the aftermath of exercise that may or may not be related. Overall, the exam is reassuring. It certainly doesn't show us signs of anything in the actual pharynx. And so maybe the framing of this case as acute pharyngitis is not accurate, right? Because her throat looked visually quite clear, no inflammation, no redness, no pus, no drainage, no swelling, no abscess, or anything like that in there. So that's all reassuring. So I'm kind of back to, like I said at the beginning, translating this more from throat pain to just kind of like anterior neck to just generalized neck pain that's exacerbated by swallowing, and back to thinking about all the different structures in the area rather than just thinking about like the back of the throat itself, just to make sure that my differential kind of stays broad enough here. And then when I think about things that happen abruptly, symptoms that happen really abruptly in medicine, they tend to be limited to like a handful of different mechanisms of disease can lead to very abrupt onset symptoms. Usually something might tear, something might rupture or perforate, something might occlude or block, something might, you know, dissect. Those are the types of things that can happen really quickly. Sorry, dissect, excuse me.
Okay, God, triggered. Yeah, triggered.
There are a handful of other mechanisms of pathology that happen really abruptly like this. And so maybe I'm wondering, was there something about the training session, about her, she had some anatomic vulnerability, maybe with some intrathoracic pressure, some vulnerability that led to some kind of tear, perforation, rupture, dissection of some structure in or about the neck? Could be related to the airway, the trachea, one of the, as I mentioned on the outset, one of the vessels in the area, something other than just the actual throat or like the upper kind of lumen, the tube that we are able to visualize just by looking in her mouth. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm still hesitant, as you can tell, to jump to very specific pathologies because I mentioned a few examples of the vascular kind, which I'm not terribly suspicious of. Those are a little bit less likely to be associated with kind of the swallowing difficulty. And then the airway, as if there's some kind of, I don't know, tracheal injury, tracheal rupture, something like that, I would expect a lot more breathing issues, distress, something like that on findings. And then lastly, when we look at this objective data, yeah, you're right. You've learned my thoughts on the white count as well as these other labs, which have been unrevealing so far. And then the X-ray, quite useful because if somebody did have, for example, a pneumothorax or an esophageal rupture, both of those would lead to air accumulation in places where there shouldn't be air. And that's something that we can sometimes see on a chest X-ray based on how things change or shift around, et cetera. So at this point, what I would be doing, I would feel like I have a little bit of time to get to the bottom of this, meaning I'm not rushing to get this patient intubated because I'm worried about the integrity of her airway or something like that based on her vitals and her exam and things like that. So we do have a little bit of time. You mentioned that a neck X-ray is pending. That may or may not be useful. I mean, plain film X-rays like this are great for looking at bones and certain other things, but there's a lot that they can miss. And so a patient like this who had this syndrome, who has normal vital signs, in whom I have some at least 30 minutes to get to the bottom of this, I would probably be ordering a contrasted neck CT or CT soft tissues of the neck with contrast is usually the way that we would go about this to take a look at those structures in more detail. Specifically, I'm with specific attention to the vessels, to whatever extent the airway is in that little section that would be visualized there, and then any other surrounding soft tissue type findings to see if anything jumps out at me.
Yeah, you know, another thought, and this will lead into the rest of the case, is this patient turned up to the emergency room, right, because of this worsening pain, okay? All the workup that she's had so far, including like getting into a room, getting her history taken, getting the vitals taken, and these other tests, maybe 30 minutes worth of work / waiting for like various things to happen. And if the average time in the ED, the emergency department, is like 2.5 hours, if you don't get admitted, and maybe double that if you do get admitted, we've effectively ruled out all the stuff that we think is going to like kill you dead now. At what point, and again, understanding that you're not an emergency medicine physician, and so, you know, you don't have that sort of horror stories that might sway you in a different way. When are you kicking this person out? Not because you're adversarial, but you're like, look, we got to keep these beds open so we get more, can have more folks in here should they turn up. At what point are you thinking, this workup needs to be finished, but we can do this outpatient?
Yeah. Yeah, it is a judgment call. Although I don't work in the emergency department, I'm often in the emergency department for consultation purposes, that they might call me to see a patient and either admit them or offer an opinion on whether they should be admitted or if I think that they are in fact safe to go home. And so there are certainly situations where I might recommend discharging a patient home from the emergency department if I feel comfortable, confident in their evaluation that, you know, that life or limb threatening conditions, at least in the immediate term, have been sufficiently excluded or are of sufficiently low probability that it is okay for them to go home and finish that. I think that, you know, there is some sense of like experience and your gut on some of these patients. You know, when I'm looking at a patient with chest pain, you know, there's certainly like certain criteria that you might go by and scoring systems that, you know, sometimes are used to guide some of these decisions. But at the same time, if the scoring system tells me that they're okay, but something about, you know, deep in my gut tells me I don't feel good about this person, then I'm going to admit them. That's often for the best, I have found. In this case, the thing that is, you know, even though her vitals are normal, her exam is mostly normal outside of, I think you mentioned some tenderness anteriorly in the neck, which is one of the things that I would like to have a sufficient explanation for that. Most of her labs and her chest x-ray so far are also appear to be normal. So just based on these objective findings, quote unquote, you could make the case that, yeah, this, you know, a lot of bad stuff has been ruled out and this patient's likely okay to go home. I think the thing that sticks out to me is the abruptness, the speed of progression, the severity of this syndrome. And then the fact that, again, I have this tenderness that I can't really explain, right? I haven't found an explanation for it. Whereas if, for example, she came in with this and we looked in the back of her throat and it was just like lit up with red and pus draining back there, when we'd say, okay, yeah, I have an explanation for this. As long as there's no abscess back there, I can give you some antimicrobials and be okay to go home, right? But it's a combination of like the severity and speed of progression of this syndrome and a lack of sufficient explanation for it that is pushing me to go a bit further in the evaluation before I would feel comfortable letting this patient go home.
Yeah, well, you got that one wrong because they did send her home. The patient was discharged home with the diagnosis of esophageal irritation secondary to GERD. She was given an antacid and Tylenol number 3. That's Tylenol with codeine for pain relief, which interesting sending somebody home on that with like maybe some concern over.
It's a terrible drug, although it was used a whole bunch during a period of time where it was like the least DEA scheduled drug. I remember this going through residency when things were changing around at the time. But yeah, codeine's a trash drug.
The pending neck x-ray came back showing normal cervical vertebra, but increased radiolucency. That's a fancy way of saying just darker areas, these pockets of dark areas that branch out into streaks adjacent to the anterior paravertebral muscles, right? So that is the radiology read. And so subsequently, you know, the physician has decided either leave that alone or maybe call the patient. But before I go any further about the diagnosis and the course, Austin and listeners at home, this is the time you have to weigh in your final answer. What is the diagnosis and what would you do?
Gotcha. Okay. So just I'm kind of visualizing in my mind's eye what you are describing on this x-ray.
Would you like me to show you a photo of this?
Oh, if you're able to. Sure.
I can. Now, Austin, while I'm showing you this photo and you're, you know, looking at it, interpreting it, please don't try to like Google image search this back just to get the diagnosis because that would be unfair.
Yeah. Okay. So this is essentially what I suspected you were describing. And so, as I mentioned, x-rays are good for some things and not so good for others. And in this situation, quite good at looking at the bones. And as was mentioned by the radiologist, the bones appear to be just fine. One of the other things that they can be good for is seeing the presence of air. And so this kind of dark appearance that we're seeing in the soft tissues that are other kind of dark areas in a sea of lighter stuff that is all the soft tissue is suggestive to me that there is some air in that kind of compartment. We see this, for example, when people have, sometimes we'll see with a patient who's had a chest tube placed, for example, in certain situations that can lead to a complication where there can get air that spreads throughout the soft tissues of the chest wall. And it's one of the more interesting exam findings. When you press on their chest, it kind of feels like you're pressing on Rice Krispies. We call that kind of subcutaneous emphysema, or crepitations of the skin and soft tissues. This is looks to me like air in that soft tissue space that is just anterior to the spine in this patient. So this is not something that I've actually managed before or seen, but kind of like I mentioned earlier, in terms of the mechanism, the potential mechanism, the abruptness, the speed that it progressed at, I was concerned for one possible thing being some kind of like a rupture or a perforation or something like that. So I'm concerned that whether from her trachea, her airway, her lungs, something like that, I'm concerned that there might've been some kind of focus of injury there, maybe related to her training, Valsalva, something like that, that then led air to be able to escape from where it should have been and enter this kind of soft tissue plane and potentially even dissect through some of it in some way. And so I would be essentially Googling the name of what is it called when there is air in this particular compartment. Because whereas there are well-known terms, for example, when you have air in the pleural space around your lungs, we call that a pneumothorax. If you have air in your mediastinum, pneumomediastinum, you have air in your pericardium, we call it pneumopericardium. This particular space, when there's air in there, I suspect it has its own name. Just doing some preliminary, I just did like a very quick search of like air in that territory, maybe something called like pneumorachus, which is a word that I've never heard before. Maybe I'm on track, but that's what I'm most concerned about is air in a space that it isn't supposed to. And then because of the context, the history, the story, the abruptness, I'm worried about some airway related structure, like rupturing, perforating, tearing, something like that, leading to this complication.
Yeah. And if you want to look at the photo, it is the thumbnail for this episode. I used it to throw people off the scent, but now if you want to review what this picture actually looks like, take a look at the arrows.
Hey everyone, I hope that you're enjoying the podcast. I just wanted to remind you that we have launched our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, Plus members get early access to our podcast, ad-free listening, written transcripts and summaries, videos, exclusive access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. And just think, no more of these ads. Thanks for your support. Now back to the podcast. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop for and prepare healthy meals. The days are getting shorter, but your to-do lists aren't. So instead of reaching for your phone to order out or heading to the nearest restaurant, let Factor help you take the stress out of eating healthy this fall. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the cooking fatigue, and instead get chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including everything from vegan to high-protein options. Find guilt-free comfort foods like homestyle chicken and gravy and loaded mashed potato pork chops. Also feel-good vegan options like sweet potato and chickpea curry and gourmet plus dishes like truffle butter filet mignon. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. Now, if you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. As we gather with loved ones this Thanksgiving, consider how learning a new language can enhance your connections and enrich your experiences. You guys know I've been trying to learn French using a competitor, Babbel, before I was endorsing Rosetta Stone. And while I had a good experience with Babbel getting ready for my trip to France, Rosetta Stone offers 12 more languages than Babbel, including many Asian languages that Babbel does not. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal. Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice, along with the correct accent, using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off by visiting rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off on limited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life by redeeming 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up. And according to the 2022 annual data breach report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the U.S. in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni.
So yeah, this patient was diagnosed with, they called it prevertebral emphysema, secondary to the Valsalva maneuver. I can't tell you what the difference between like a pneumo prefix and then like calling it emphysema, like where is the line in the sand?
Yeah.
But in any case, she was counseled to not lift heavy until there was radiographic resolution. So basically when they did another x-ray or other sort of imaging modality, this wasn't there. And so, yeah, she had that in 5 days, complete resolution of these findings. And she was sent back to the gym. She was also advised not to fly for 2 weeks due to this sort of potential risk of barotrauma and a lifelong contraindication to diving, which I understand just due to the pressure change, but that's deeply unsatisfying because it's like, look, if there is some sort of underlying predisposition towards this, perhaps identifying that would be useful. But, you know, I thought it was an interesting case.
It is. I'm curious that they didn't chase it further to evaluate like the anatomy of her airways and to see was there any kind of predisposition. Oftentimes when people have had a pneumothorax, we look to see was there some kind of, you know, blebs in the lungs or something like that. And that's a situation where if you've had a pneumothorax before, yeah, they tell you the same thing, that you should not go scuba. That would be a bad idea for you. So I'm satisfied with the way that we got to the diagnosis and with my determination of the diagnosis, just based on like piecing together the syndrome and the speed and the imaging findings we have here. I'm left somewhat unsatisfied by the lack of identification of you know, an anatomic vulnerability here. Maybe identifiable, maybe not, but yeah, pretty interesting one. I can't say I've seen this phenomenon in real life, but just being able to look at an x-ray and identifying what air looks like in soft tissues, that made this more straightforward. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, so let's talk about some pearls here. We're going to talk about spontaneous emphysema and the Valsalva maneuver. So yeah, this case was basically spontaneous emphysema, according to the case report, within the prevertebral space. Now, if you're like, you said vertebra, I know where those are. Generally speaking, where is this prevertebral space? Well, imagine a space where your skull is on top, the cervical vertebra, so the bones of your neck, are the back, right? Your sternum is below, and basically the soft tissue of your neck, so the fascia, skin, et cetera, is in the front. So this space contains the deep muscles of the neck that help you flex your neck like you're nodding, or if you're bouncing your head to, you know, Busta Rhymes, because he said to protect your neck, and that's how you got here. So you can get emphysema, which is to get air in a place, in this particular case, like subcutaneous emphysema, that's air under the skin, for example, it's air in a place you don't want it to be. This can happen with trauma or surgeries in the area. So there's a few case reports of like dental procedures, for example, that introduce air into this space. But since this was without trauma, according to the case report, the proposed mechanism actually has a fancy eponym called the Macklin effect. This was first described by a Dr. Macklin. He was a Canadian pulmonologist in 1939. And effectively, he talks about some rupture of lung tissue, whether it's an alveolus or whether it's some sort of bleb or whatever. And then air dissects out of the lung space and infiltrates another sort of thing. So three major steps. some part of the lung, like there's some trauma to it. In this particular case, not due to external trauma, but just blows, right? And then air leaves the space and goes somewhere else. In this case, they're attributing it to a Valsalva. So his whole case report thing that he first described in the 1930s and subsequently further characterized includes the Valsalva maneuver as a sort of maybe the inciting event, but also includes like crush injuries and like other major sorts of trauma. The idea is that the Valsalva increases intrathoracic pressure, which would then cause some sort of pulmonary bleb, as you referred to earlier, to burst and release air that dissects into the surrounding tissues along fascial planes. And one of those fascial planes is up into the neck. And if you're like, fascial plane, what is that? Well, fascia is just this thin bit of connective tissue that envelopes the muscle. And so it creates these, they're not highways by any stretch of the imagination, but if you were trying to get from one space of the body to another space, going along these planes would be easier because it effectively is a little bit more open, even though it does keep everything else inside. The barotrauma stuff during resolution, that makes sense to me. Although it did seem interesting that they were like, hey, just don't lift anything heavy until we see a picture that shows it's all good. And I'm like, would you do another x-ray or would you have done like a something, maybe a step up just to make sure that there's no like air in the space?
If I just wanted to evaluate for the air that was seen the first time, I would be content with seeing a clear interval improvement on a repeat x-ray. But again, like I said, my management of this patient, I think, up front in the emergency department, who had like unexplained severe progressive neck and throat pain, would have probably involved the CT on the first presentation. Mm-hmm. And then from there, if that was what I had at baseline, then it would be, you know, relatively easy to, you know, repeat that down the line to assess for resolution with in a more cross-sectional kind of imaging modality that gives us more information.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the Valsalva quickly. So the Valsalva maneuver is this attempted forced expiration or breathing out against a closed glottis. So basically the top of your trachea is closed off. So you're trying to breathe out, but you're not. And so it increases pressure. We do this in a ton of different activities, like routine activities during the day, such as going to the bathroom, having sex, and other non-routine activities for many folks, like working out. Doing the Valsalva increases the pressure in the thorax, that's where your lungs sit, and the abdomen, that's where all your visceral organs sit. And in healthy individuals, the average intra-abdominal pressure while standing upright is about 20 millimeters of mercury. And then when you do a Valsalva, it goes up to about 65 millimeters of mercury. It goes up to about 3 to 4 times that when people are like deadlifting or squatting heavy weights, and even more so when they use a belt. So effectively, you get this sort of synergistic effect by doing a Valsalva and using a belt. Now, when we look at studies that compare people who are trying to lift weights with and without a Valsalva, it is very, very clear that when people do a Valsalva, they're able to lift either heavier weights or lift the same weight but do more reps, or lift the same weight for the same number of reps, but each rep is faster. So force production goes up, and we think the most likely mechanism is because the trunk segments, so the abdomen and the thorax, are stiffer, and so therefore better able to transfer force. There may be some other mechanisms involved, whether that is an increase in sympathetic nervous system activity, some other sort of ideas around this, but mainly we think it's maybe this mechanical thing about force transfer. And people will do a Valsalva when exercising anyway, if the effort gets challenging, even if they're coached to breathe in during the concentric phase or the way down and breathe out during the eccentric phase, it's just bad advice. This idea of like breathing in and then breathing out during a rep, people say this all the time. Even in like clinical care settings, like cardiac rehab, for example, others like various PT settings where there's some sort of risk or perceived, real or otherwise. And it's like, you can't do that. And it's not meaning you can't say that. Like, of course, you can say it, but people will not do it. Any sort of challenging effort, you're going to automatically, reflexively Valsalva, because it's a human reflex. When we need to create more force, we do the Valsalva. Whether that force is going to the bathroom, whether it's having sex, whether it's lifting weights, we'll do a Valsalva. So one study actually had a healthy individual's squat with and without a Valsalva maneuver. Now, I don't love the study design. First, they were squatting. That's cool. With and without a Valsalva, that's cool. Check the box. And when it came to load selection, they're like, we're going to use a percentage of your body weight. And I'm like, you were so close to coming up with like a useful study, but I guess this will do. So they had people squat with and without a Valsalva 80% of their body weight for a set of 10. The systolic blood pressure increase from resting by 13 millimeters of mercury without a Valsalva and 15 millimeters of mercury with the Valsalva, which is not only statistically insignificant, it's not clinically significant either.
Although you could also argue that the weight they were lifting was also clinically insignificant as well.
Totally. Or you could also argue if these were untrained individuals, having 80% of your body weight on the bar for a set of 10, maybe that is challenging enough. And so that's why there's no difference.
Sure.
Right? The whole point is like, we really care about, a systolic blood pressure increase of less than like 50. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like even like you could double that. And I'd be like, why does this matter?
Yeah. I mean, people's blood pressures, I think that, you know, since most people, even though there's, hype these days about people wearing continuous glucose monitors, nobody's wearing a continuous blood pressure monitor. I think they would be quite surprised to see the range of blood pressures that they experience on a routine daily basis if that were something they had continuous insight into.
Totally. Another study compared the cardiac response of pregnant women to non-pregnant women when doing leg press at 40% of their 10 rep max with and without a Valsalva. And so again, because when you go down this rabbit hole of like Valsalva and like, oh, who shouldn't do the Valsalva? It's like, oh, anybody with a cardiac condition. And it's like, that seems like overly cautious to the extent that it could be done anyway, which it can't, which makes it bad advice. And then the next, population is pregnant women. If you're pregnant, if you're with child, you cannot do a Valsalva because that's going to compromise blood flow to baby, for example, or potentially you and baby. Well, there were no differences observed in blood pressure response to exercise, cardiac mechanics, ejection fraction with or without the Valsalva maneuver. It was the same. And again, it's pretty light. So like if there was any of an effort that you could actually like breathe in on the way down and breathe out on the way up, this would be it. 40% of your 10 rep max. Jeez, come on. Like you have to put like a band on the sled to assist, to make it lighter. And with or without pregnancy, no difference if they were pregnant or not. And so again, I understand being overly cautious and risk averse here, particularly when it comes to the Valsalva maneuver, which I just think it scares some people. Like, particularly once you learn like the cardiorespiratory response to exercise or doing the Valsalva, particularly out of context of exercise. But the Valsalva maneuver, by and large, is safe. It's effective for exercise and largely unavoidable, particularly if the effort is challenging. As for this particular case, I would say that, yeah, exercise is not without risk, but the risks are very low overall. Sometimes, however, you just get unlucky. And that's as far as I can describe this particular patient with the prevertebral emphysema. Bad outcome from being unlucky. Fortunately, had she never gone to the emergency room, I suspect she is likely to be just fine unless she, had a scuba lesson the next morning, in which case that would have been problematic.
Yeah, agree. And most of the time, to the extent you said learning about the cardiovascular response to the Valsalva maneuver might, instill some fear in someone. Really, it's like very sustained Valsalvas. It takes holding it for a while before you get to the point that the decrease in venous return leads to a compromising cardiac output that can lead to, problems like people getting lightheaded and passing out and other complications that are pretty uncommon in general, right? Especially at the loads that you were describing and the rep schemes and stuff like that, people were not sitting there doing a maximal sustained Valsalva for a full set of 10, I suspect. It is very likely that you could just reset in between reps. And with a load with loads that light, again, the type of Valsalva that they're doing is not like my kind of Valsalva that I've done under my absolute heaviest deadlifts or that you've done under your absolute heaviest squats. So,
yeah, but to that end, you've trained yourself,
yeah,
and not just you, like your whatever makes you, your conscious being, your soul, but like your entire physiology is now different,
yep,
and adapted to what you've been doing. So, like, can you imagine going through some sort of medical procedure, and then the doctor comes in and sees you, hey, Dr. Baraki, you told everything went well, you're going to recover, heal up just fine. But hey, man, and I just checked your Instagram, super impressed with what you're doing. But can you just like not, hold your breath when you lift for like the next month?
Or anything over 5 pounds.
All right, anything like that. You'd be like, I feel like I know you. And I feel like one of two things is going to happen. One of two things. The first thing would be like, okay.
Yeah.
just like, don't care, not engaging, whatever. But the second part is like, if you had maybe an extra hour to kill or something, you'd be like, why? So, you know, is there like good evidence here? Like, where do these recommendations come from? You know, just some curiosity. Yeah. I don't know. Like, but people get that advice all the time.
Yeah, they do. They do. And these kind of post-op recommendations are unfortunately poorly supported by, you know, direct evidence. A lot of it is practitioner preference. It's kind of physiologic hypothesizing, erring on the conservative side. And as we've talked about before, it's like, if it's a week of pretty restricted activity, that's not going to like make or break most people. If it's much longer than that, if it's repeated, recurrent, you know, breaks like that, then that can become more of an issue. And there's often like something that you can do rather than, you know, scaling it from, you know, full on normal full bore training to like effectively nothing but walking, for example. There's usually something in between. But even if not, for whatever reason, and so you're right, my two responses would either just be okay, or the alternative, rather than asking why with some you know, laden with snark, it would rather be something like, can you tell me what you're most worried about, if, you know, in the setting of exercise, just so I have a sense of, is there something that they know of or think of as a complication of that procedure that I don't know, right? That would be the way that I would tease that out. And obviously, you know, I'm operating fortunately with, you know, more medical knowledge and understanding than like a layperson undergoing a procedure and getting this same kind of advice to be able to evaluate, you know, that kind of answer. But yeah, there's, people can usually do more than they think, but even if there's a very short period of time where you're doing less than you want, that's usually going to be okay.
All right. So this is the last thing I want to ask you, and I'm not just trying to drag this out. It just thought just did occur to me, and I wonder if you agree or not. Okay. So if we agree that the post-op exercise got, you know, recommendations, generally speaking, if some people talk 1 week off, 2 weeks off, okay, don't really care. We are in agreement there. However, if I'm flipping the script, I think it's really just a missed opportunity to counsel people on exercise. Rather, you've provided them another barrier against exercise, and that sort of interface with the healthcare system. And they'd be like, hey, look, for the next week or two, don't exercise. Or don't exercise strenuously or whatever the recommendation is. But week three, right at the start of week three, here's exactly what I want you to do. Here's a handout. It's just a missed opportunity, I feel like.
Yeah, you could even frame it beyond that point. This is actually going to accelerate your return to normal function or improve your outcomes or something. That's an excellent, I think, point. And I think it's something that would be great if it were more widely adopted, because a lot of patients listen, you know, to their doctors on this kind of thing, especially when it comes to restriction. But if you tied that with restriction up to this point, and then here's what I think would give you the best outcomes, I do think that there's at least some fraction of patients who would respond really well to that.
Yeah. Look, if you're a medical student and you're listening to this, or you're a resident listening to this, and you have to do some sort of quality improvement project to either graduate or whatever, this is it.
Or if you're going to become a surgeon.
Yeah, this is it. Let's go. All right. Well, that is a wrap here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast Mystery Case. This case was a prevertebral emphysema. A special shout out to Dr. Austin Brocky for joining us on the podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine, and over the last 10-plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite-level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help.
Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. Chumba. And live the Chumba life. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.